Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, August 6th, 2020, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested. That was different.
I think it hit the time limit too.
He did. It was exactly 15 seconds. That intro was created by David. Thank you, David, for sending that one in. It was tricky.
Takes me back to Los Angeles 2019. That was very Blade Runner.
A little Vangelis. Yeah, a little bit there for sure. I dug
Loved it. He said it was entirely analog.
Oh,
what?
Yeah, wow. No digital synth.
Does that skew the curve a little bit?
I love it.
Extra points for that?
Yes.
I really dug that intro. I don't know if it's if it lands. You know what I mean? It maybe 15 seconds isn't enough to ramp up with a landing. It just is kind of mood.
Don't bias the listeners. Let them have their experience.
All right. Well, yes. People really loved the metal intro last week. And all this is to say, if you want to create a 15 to 20 second intro for us to play, send me an email, upload it to SoundCloud, norman@tested.com, and I will play it in a future episode. We have about a dozen of them queued up, and we'll get through all of them, I promise.
I love them.
It's something to look forward to every week, right?
Exactly.
It's not just the catching up, but it's also something new for listeners out there. You get to it's a little bit of anticipation, and I'm just really happy that people are sharing them. But has it been quite a week? I don't know. What is time? It feels like it's been weeks since we podcasted last. I guess we talked about Comic-Con last week. What's been going on? Jeremy, you had something you wanted to show off, kick off the podcast.
Show and tell.
Yes.
Who doesn't love show and tell?
Especially on an audio podcast, right?
It's not strictly audio. And so if you are on audio, you might want to check out the YouTube feed. We can describe what I'm about to hold up to the camera. I ordered this 4 months ago from Russia on
eBay. RAM?
And it finally arrived. I'm going to put on the focus there. It finally arrived this week.
It looks like memory.
Norm, you're very astute. This is a stick of RAM.
Yeah.
That is 55 years old.
What?
This is core memory, magnetic ferrite core memory, right? So this was basically what memory looked like before Intel came along in the 70s with semiconductor memory.
So for people listening to audio, let's paint a word picture here.
Yeah.
Because unlike a modern stick of RAM, or what do you even think of in the modern era of RAM, which is a PCB with chips on it. This is a metal frame. It's a square frame about 6 inches by 6 inches, and a frame because it's in the center of the frame. It's empty space except for wires that are interlaced horizontally and vertically.
Very nice.
It's almost like it was made on a loom. It was stitched.
And in fact,
loom of data.
These were handmade. Where's my focus? There it is. These were handmade. And this is what memory looked like for 20 years, from 1955 to 1975 about. And this particular stick here, what they call a plane, has 4,096 bits on it. So about 512 bytes. And for people who don't think in terms of bytes, a byte holds about a letter of the alphabet. So you can store 512 letters on this thing. And the bits are stored using these little rings on here, which are magnetically charged based on the polarity of the electricity that runs through it. And these rings can flip to either 0 or 1. You have 4,000 of them on here. So that's how it stores bits. Basically, you have energy coming in here and energy coming here, and it flips it one way or the other. And then it has another wire that can read the charge. But in order to read the charge, you actually have to erase the memory. So
right, it flips it back.
You can store it, and in fact, it's non-volatile memory because you can turn the power off and it will keep its state. But in order to find out what the state is, you have to erase it.
Ooh, it's very Heisenberg.
That's amazing.
You're by reading it, you disrupt it.
Exactly, because they send the charge. They basically set everything to 0, and wherever they see a charge, they know that must have been 1.
Right, right.
And
that's electromechanical.
Exactly. And I guess there were like 14 of these in a cube of memory. And that's what you put in your computer in order to have it store things. I mean, incredible stuff. I just love the idea that there was a period of time where you can look at the mechanics of RAM and actually see how it worked. You know, it's like opening a pinball machine. You can sort of see how the electricity flows to the solenoids and what a flipper button does. You can still kind of see the engineering. But inside a computer these days, it's almost impossible. You can go look in Wikipedia and see amazing scans of microchips, and it's incredible. The technology is mind-blowing. But you can't grasp it. You can't actually physically touch it. And you can touch this RAM. I mean, I could flip bits with my finger if I wanted to. And I just think it's fantastic. And well worth the wait.
Is something you just found on eBay?
Yeah, I mean, I learned about it, and then I was like, well, I have to have one. And I went on eBay, and it turns out, it seems like all of the stuff from the U.S. is more or less bought up by collectors and is in museums and such. It was quite expensive if I wanted anything domestically. So, yeah, this was actually RAM from a clone of a DEC U.S., what they called a compact computer, but really was like a mainframe in the mid-60s. And they used the exact same technology from Russia. And this cost me, I think, about $20 plus shipping.
It's exactly the kind of thing that you'd find at the Computer History Museum down in Mountain View. That's a wonderful museum that when we're able to go to museums again, people should definitely visit. They had a Babbage computer that was rebuilt or built.
They have an online exhibit about the Babbage machine, actually, so you can actually see it. They actually brought that to the science festival I used to run once at AT&T Park. They had a Babbage machine just like up in the stadium.
Wow.
That you could they let people kind of interact with it a little bit.
When I was researching this, those guys actually have a YouTube video where they did the same thing. They picked one up off of eBay and they got it working again. They hooked it up to an Arduino and some probes and were able to send charges to the bits and flip them and read them in the exact same way.
So 4,000 bytes.
Bits.
Bits. 2 byte. That's how many intersections there are, presumably.
Right.
So how many horizontal and vertical actual lines are there?
I guess there would have to be 200 by 200 or is it 512 by 512? I'm not sure. I haven't actually counted. But if there's 1,024 in each of these quadrants. I'd do the math.
Yeah. And so you need that many probes.
You can see these tips, like they all run as they do like in current. Microchips, like they have through what would we think of as like through hole, terminals. You can hook up alligator clips to the end of these and make them work really easily.
Well, I'm just saying you would need that many number of alligator clips
across
the entire row to program all 4,000 of those bits.
Exactly.
There should be 64 wires on each side.
Ah, thank you.
It's very elegant. That. 64 by 64, some math there. Kishore, you have anything to show and tell? Anything from this past week? You've been working on
right now. I'm waiting for a last couple parts, but I'm building a standing desk setup. And I'm waiting for the desk part of the standing desk setup, but have a mechanical keyboard that has come in. I'm getting in the game for the first time in a while, and all sorts of peripherals. So I think I'll have some show and tell next week, hopefully, if things arrive on time.
Very cool. There's something that I'll probably have a video on in a week and a half's time, but I wanted to mention it at Maker Faire a year ago now. I don't remember, but we met someone who was working on a prototype toy kit called Snapships. I don't know if you guys saw it when you went to Maker Faire. It was in the dark room, what previously was the dark room, but basically it was ex video game designers that developed a modular kind of a building system for vehicles, for spaceships, like Lego. And the whole idea is that they would be like Greeblies, that you would pick them up and then mix and match and interlock them to build your spaceships. And he was just testing it out. They were like 3D printed prototypes, but we did a video on them. And with that, they have now partnered with the toy company and they are now on Amazon and in Target. And I got a couple boxes and they're really fun. Yeah, so I want to give that a shout out, Snapships. And it's really great. It's really great to see them go from prototyping at Maker Faire to actually being, not just in store shelves, but online as well.
And distributed. Awesome.
Yeah. Speaking of Lego, this past Sunday or Saturday, Saturday morning, the Lego NES set went on sale. I hope people were able to get their sets. I think they're still available. I don't know if they've quite sold out yet, but the PSA is there if you want to get that Nintendo set. Mine still has not arrived yet. It's still on a truck traveling the country.
Mine's due on Friday.
Kentucky. I think same here. Yeah. But I know people who have been able to go to stores. I've seen people build them and post them on Twitter. It looks good. The Nintendo, the NES part of it itself is, as we surmise, smaller than the actual NES, but much bigger than the NES Mini. So you have this whole scale range of NESs that you can have.
Is there really any excuse for Lego selling out of a kit? Because really, it's just the box that they have to manufacture that's unique.
No.
There's a few unique parts inside there, but mainly, like most of the product are molds that they have billions of somewhere.
Yes, but it's all about how many sets they want in their logistic process, right? It's, yes, technically, if someone's like, you know, the world is ending, we need this Lego set from this year ago. Yes, they would be able to break out some molds. Like they have them buried underneath, I think, the original plates, the injection molds, somewhere on their campus, but they could technically make them, but it's about allocation of time in the production line. Like their factories will make this many for these months, and that's based on their analysis of the market demand for it. And to redo that would then take the place of another product that they would have on offer, and it's not worth it to, you know, make a fraction of a reissue if they can make a whole new line and sell, you know, 10 times as many or however many times. Yeah, so that's why Lego goes out of stock a lot of times. You know, sometimes they don't estimate properly the demand for things, whether under or over evaluating. And I think this one, they probably have made a lot because, and rightly so, because the set looks beautiful. I can't wait to put it together. $230 on Lego.com. All right, let's now move over to, because we've got to do a Brisk podcast, our top story.
Top story this week.
All righty, let's talk about Mulan. Let's talk about Mulan 2020. The big news in the film world this week was on Disney's quarterly earnings call. The Disney CEO, New Bob made the announcement that Mulan, which was a film that's wrapped and actually had a premiere in Los Angeles, but did not hit theaters in the U.S. because the lockdown happened right before its premiere date. It is going to open internationally in theaters and at some point may even be in theaters in the U.S. But come September 4th, Disney is allowing, it's going the digital route for this big budget movie that they were planning probably to make $1 billion on, and they will release it on Disney Plus with caveats.
That's half the story.
That's $30 short of the story, because it is going to be a release that you can buy on Disney Plus if you're a current subscriber and pay an additional $30. So I think
you have thoughts.
I have a lot of thoughts. Obviously, Universal Studios did this with Trolls, right? Trolls World Tour was a instead of a theatrical release, it made a ton of money, made a lot of news, being a digital release first. And it was a rental system. So as in lieu of it going to a theater chain, you paid $20, you rented it at home through a variety of services. And then after a couple of weeks, you know, whatever the classic 17-week window, it then was available to buy and rent in traditional platforms for like $2-3 for rental, or you can buy it for $20 as the typical movie would be.
And it was a huge success.
And it was a huge success in, you know, in that it was one of the first movies to do that. Clearly it was a movie that Universal had planned on making a lot of money in theaters because the first movie was a success. But a lot of movies since then have gone VOD first because theaters aren't open. That's a very, very accepted practice now, especially with the big negotiation, the deal between Universal Studios and AMC Theaters that we talked about last week, where now AMC has only a smaller exclusivity window of a few 2 weeks' time, essentially, before Universal can put those movies out for rental for full price. And then AMC also takes a cut of that. Here, this is not under any type of movie theater chain relationship. This is Disney saying, we have the service called Disney Plus that people are paying already somewhere between, you know, $7 or $10 a month for, depending on, you know, what you have bundled with it and how many you signed up for. And they have like, what is it, 50 or 70 million subscribers?
54.5 million subscribers.
54 million subscribers, which took Netflix, you know, almost a decade to get to that point. They have the numbers of people, but they still need to actually, for I believe, accounting purposes, because on their ledgers, Mulan was going to make them $1 billion plus in theaters worldwide. They need to make up for that. They've already lost $3.5 billion just from theme parks being shut down for this whole summer. So $30 on top of your Disney Plus subscription will let you own, and I'm using air quotes, own Mulan.
Wait, that's true? It's not a rental?
It is not a rental. They had to wait like half a day after the earnings call to confirm that. It's basically been, it's been bad optics and bad messaging for this announcement. I think they were...
You don't sound in favor of this.
I'm in favor of I'm in favor of Disney and other movie studios putting movies out on VOD because I understand you can't go to theaters right now. I think it's a disservice to the filmmakers for this movie in particular, because this is a big tentpole movie for Disney. And I don't believe they'll do this for Black Widow. I think that they have higher expectations for Black Widow. And I think that is a disservice to the fans of Mulan. For them to elevate an MCU movie over this, because they said on the call, this isn't going to be a trend. This is going to be a one-off. But the big problem is that this is on Disney Plus.
This is a learning experience. They're saying it's a one-off because they're going to see what happens. And when they see what happens, and if it's huge, then you can bet they will do this again.
I think they would rather postpone Black Widow for 6 months, another 6 months, than put Black Widow out on Disney Plus. Because I don't think Mulan on Disney Plus at $30 a pop is going to make them $1 billion.
It's going to make. Let's do some math, actually. Oh. So if they have 54.5 million subscribers, the math guess is how many of those are going to rent buy this movie?
1%.
Quarter? I was going to say 10%.
Really, only 10%? I think up to a quarter could.
Well, Jeremy said 1%.
1%.
1%.
Okay, I'm of two minds about this. Number one, I will be buying it because I have a family of four and the economics make sense. If I were to take them to go see this movie, it would be a lot more than $30. But
and you famously hate seeing movies at theaters and people.
I am famous for saying that. That's absolutely
yes. Like you Google Jeremy Williams, that's the first result.
And I have a new sound bar, which I'm very happy with. Yeah. And I will be getting the full-fledged movie experience at
home. No. You'll be getting the full home theater experience as best as that can be at home. Let's not call this the full theatrical experience.
Norm, but let's get off our high horse. Like, let's stop pretending that the theater experience is all like it's made up to be.
On the other hand, this is $30 on top of a subscription fee, people. Yep, and that is something nobody has tried before. And not anything that any of the people who are Disney Plus subscribers will be expecting. Like they'll see it's on Disney Plus and they'll think, oh, cool, I was looking forward to that. I'm going to watch that tonight. And then they're going to be charged.
That's not exactly true. I think that's a messaging thing because I have Amazon Prime. I get stuff on Prime. If I go open my Prime app, it has all this whole section that's like rent a movie.
Dude, you have Amazon
Prime. That's not that different.
Prime, your Prime video stuff is like a bonus. You have Prime for the shipping. Everything else is kind of gravy. Disney
I get it. I think it's a framing thing, though, more than a framing and messaging than it is an act. I don't know if I believe that that's actually going to be an intellectual hurdle. If they actually frame this as like, hey, you can't go to a movie theater right now. Like, tough. Yeah. You know, we're going to release this. It's $30. you know, maybe they won't say this, but the underpinning is it's cheaper than if you took your family to go see this. And that's really the truth. Like, I get it's not the big screen, it's not the big sound, but it's a whole lot less money than if I went to the theater with my family.
Monetarily, I think you're right. I think the optics are terrible in this because it really feels like double dipping. It's like, remember On Live, right? Or even, let's talk about Stadia, right? It's like those services where you're all this user backlash because you're asking someone to subscribe to something and then on top of that, pay to have the right to play that thing. And even though it's not a rental in this case, it's to play it multiple times. It's only for the duration of your Disney Plus subscription. So it's not on an existing platform like iTunes. And I don't know if this is a way to get around their fee, like the 30% cut that Apple's going to take. I bet doesn't get around the fee. It's an in-app purchase, right? You're paying for a subscription plus it's an in-app purchase. So that's why it's priced $30 over $20. But they're limiting the number of the potential audience to the 54 million. And that just reeks of, one, a poor optics for the existing subscribers who are maybe confused about this, to Jeremy's point. And two, for anyone who doesn't have Disney Plus, who may be interested in Mulan, maybe that's not a Venn diagram that intersects heavily, but that's, you know, 200, that's hundreds of millions of households across the world.
Yeah. I tend to agree that I'm surprised the mechanic wasn't you can rent Mulan on any platform VOD for $30. But if you do it through Disney Plus, it stays in your library as long as you're a Disney Plus subscriber.
Or is discounted.
Like, make it like some sort of like, you know, mild perk in that way.
Yeah.
But I also think like the math here is closer than you think, depending on how many people you think are actually going to purchase this. If it's 1%, like Jeremy says, no math is ever going to be in your favor. But if it's a quarter of their subscriber base that does it, that amounts to around like $410 million. Lion King live action made $545 domestic. So it's like within a ballpark, you know, it's not zero. That's the other thing. So their conversion rate is the key here. If it's going to be 1%, 10%, 20, 25%, it makes a huge difference.
Well, it would be a mistake for them to keep the exclusive to Disney Plus in that case. They really should release it everywhere else, at least after a timed period.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like, that's part of the poor messaging about this. Not only did they not make it clear that this was going to be a pay to quote unquote own as a part of your Disney Plus subscription to unlock permanently. But you know what the further rollout that there's so much hedging in this. It feels like they've done the math on this. They know how many people watch Artemis Fowl, which was not a surcharge. And that was a previously theatrical release that they threw on Disney Plus as a way to get people to subscribe. They know how many people watch Hamilton, right, on Disney Plus, but that's also bundled as part of the subscription. And for all those folks who started subscribing to Disney Plus in July to get things like Hamilton, it's going to feel like this upsell is going to leave a bad taste in their mouth. Plus the fact that there's already kind of online backlash against this film because people have such fond memories. The Disney fans love the original Mulan, and I think the original Mulan is a great film for its time. But the fact that this is not that film, it's not your shot by shot remake. There's no Mushu character. It's not a musical. It's a straight up, it's almost like a war film. A lot of the Disney stands and the Mulan stands are not having it. And I think for something that's going to be a digital release, that kind of sentiment can turn the tide for people that feeling the moment of needing this being an essential, you know, movie to watch in the moment.
So I get that, and I think you're right. This is the live action film I've most been excited about because it is a war film, because it's going to be a different take, because like the emotional stakes inside of Mulan means there's going to be good acting performances. I think the story lends itself to a live action storytelling. So I'm here all day for this. Like, take my $30 now. I agree overall, like, if Disney Plus had been smarter about being like, this is a way to increase subscriptions, then backload the Mandalorian season 2 like a couple weeks after Mulan drops. Like, yeah. You know, they didn't quite do those like kind of connected things that makes the everything in the ecosystem work together. But all that being said, I'm here all day for this $30. It could have been $40. I would have paid it.
I really wish they did a better job of the messaging. I really wish it was a better planned rollout where people who, even if it was just iTunes, right? If it doesn't even need to be on Amazon, even if it's just on another dominant platform where Apple's going to get their cut anyway, where it's not, doesn't feel like it's a gated thing, a paywalled experience to a paywalled experience. The double paywall really doesn't look good
right.
for them. I do feel like, you know, if they have success with it, great. You know, the money might work out, like you said, Kishore, because they're not going to spend the same amount of money on marketing. But it also is, I go back to my very first point, which is that this is disappointing to the filmmakers who invested in this big theatrical experience. They didn't sell this to Netflix. So, you know, they made this movie to be seen in a big screen, and it was so close to be seen on the big screen. And even if this is a success, if Disney holds back something like Black Widow because they think they can make a couple hundred more million for that because of the fan base, then I feel like that's a disservice to this film being a tentpole. But let us know if you're going to plan on watching Mulan. It's a month time, September 4th. I wonder 24th. If we'll see a lot of... 24th. Okay, sorry. End of September. Yeah, I guess that's time so that they can do some international release in theaters as well shortly after Tenet goes back in theaters on the Warner Brothers side. We're going to continue on with pop culture. But first, I'm going to play a music cue.
Pop culture, news culture.
Not a lot this week to talk about in the world of pop culture. Streaming services, there's something interesting here. This is Netflix is going to start letting people watch their content faster or slower with playback control up to 1.5x.
Like YouTube.
Yes, like YouTube, which I think is probably why they're doing this, because a lot of people who watch content on YouTube, podcasts or videos otherwise, like speeding it up, even up to 2x. I used to do that with college lectures, stream all the time.
Tutorials, same thing. It's a wonderful thing to have when you're watching somebody instruct you and you can handle the faster pace.
2X, so, you guys are living in the past. You get, I got the Chrome extension. I'm going like 2.5 to 3 oh my, now.
That is unbelievably fast. It really depends on the pace of the person talking. And yeah. If there are visuals accompanying it, then you're pausing and, you know, and then starting. And it's a little different.
This is a harder sell on Netflix where you're actually trying to enjoy the content, not necessarily get to like some learning or something else like in the other framework. So I'm not sure how this is going to work. I just finished watching Indian Matchmaking on Netflix, which was a trip. And I tried speeding it up in one episode to get past the cringiest parts. Did make it a little less cringy for it to be sped up.
But yeah, my question,
I can't imagine actually using this much on Netflix.
My question was, if my TV is in filmmaker mode, will it allow this feature?
Hopefully not. Right?
Yeah, I would think not.
I would think, because the filmmakers are surely against this. They have been vocal in their opposition to this type of feature. You know, their argument being that Netflix is kind of like a distributor more than a TV network. And yes, even though it's a much requested feature by the users, should Netflix allow the users something that they think they want, or will it ruin the experiences of the type of content, the intent of the creator when they're making
more user control.
Oh, this is downright offensive.
This film has been optimized for 0.97x.
I am literally like, as what little filmmaking I've done in my life, but as a amateur filmmaker, I'm offended by this feature. I hope nobody uses it to watch an actual movie.
Well, it's Netflix will not roll this out and restrict it to certain types of content, right? They're not going to say, okay, for certain movies, you cannot adjust the playback speed, but for certain things, you can. I'm trying to put my mind in the head of the user that wants this. What is the content that they feel like is moving too slowly or too quickly that they want to slow it down. Now, I could
get a couple examples.
Like nature documentaries, if you don't care about the audio and you just want to see beautiful, gorgeous footage in even slower motion, you can slow it down kind of as background playback. I will give them that. But any narrative piece of narrative entertainment, does speed slowing down?
I only had two, which was one is documentaries and a certain kind of documentary, like you said. And the other is stuff you've watched a bunch before. So maybe you're watching The Office at like 1.5x because this is your like fourth time through it.
That makes no sense. If you're watching it again, you want to appreciate it. You're not going to appreciate it like better if you watch it faster.
This sounds like
there's going to be commenters question, on my side right? on this one.
Right. It's a psychology question. Do you, when you rewatch a piece of comedy, and comedy is a perfect example of this. I think there was a Twitter thread where it was a filmmaker saying that Chris Weitz? I want to say it's Chris Weitz for About a Boy. Went to a screening of his film and something was off, and it turned out the projectionist had played it back at 25 FPS on the actual real projector versus 24 FPS. And that was throwing the timing of the jokes slightly off and probably imperceptible to the audience watching in the theater, but to the filmmaker and to the writer and someone who was involved in, you know, that process, things weren't landing. Someone who had seen the film many times. Now, subconsciously, that may not matter, or it may only matter subconsciously, and it may make a film feel like the jokes aren't landing or some of the beats are a frame off. But if you're talking about rewatching something as comfort food, if you're rewatching The Office or Parks and Rec, and I'm there not necessarily for the comedic timing, do I get the same, you know, do the neurons fire in the same way if I'm just waiting for Michael Scott to say that's what she said? And at any speed, at any time, that moment where he says that, that's what I'm rewatching this for.
No, you guys are trying to justify this thing. This is stupid. It should not be a feature on Netflix. It works. It's a wonderful feature for audiobooks. It's a wonderful feature for watching lectures and how-tos. It should not It should not be on Netflix.
That's a slippery slope, because when you're saying it's a wonderful feature for audiobooks, you're also at that same time talking about an artistic performance. The audiobook reader, right? The way they act out the voices, and yes, it's different than the pace that you would process the words visually, but in that medium, it is also a performance.
Are you saying I should read at a certain pace if I'm reading the book myself?
No, you can read whatever pace you want.
Okay, just visually, making sure.
But when you're listening to it, you know, if you're listening to it just to process the text, the information, right, you're discounting the performance aspect of that audiobook in the same way that I said if you're just re-watching The Office at 1.5x speed because you appreciate the script writing but not the performances, that's what this is arguing for. You're getting the same satisfaction.
I don't know, man. If I'm listening to an audiobook, it's the voice that I would otherwise hear in my head while I'm reading the page. And that is a performance that is at whatever pace I want to read at. So there's going to be a voice, and it's going to be reading the words. It might be mine or it might be the reader's, but I'd like to be able to choose that pace. And that works for me. I don't have a problem with changing that.
Sounds like you're in favor of user choice.
But if there's an editor involved who is like taken 6 months.
Involved.
Oh, I'm sure there are editors in audiobooks. Absolutely. You're right. But it's a different thing when it comes to film. If there's an editor like that involved and a director and a lot of people who have painstakingly chosen this pace, I want that pace.
Jeremy, have you ever watched a tested video sped up? Because there are editors involved.
I can't say. I don't think I actually have, Kishore. I think I have respected.
I recommend it.
I'm not sure I haven't watched a tested video sped up in recent times.
I think you're making the case, Jeremy, that user choice. I'm just playing devil's advocate here, because I'm also in the favor of the creators. So I empathize with the creator's intent, but at the same time, I think users are going to use the way they want to consume the content. I think it's all about messaging, and you know, and I think if a viewer is going to watch that content that way, that's on them. I would just hope that. You know, that I would urge people to appreciate what the creators and how they formatted that content, you know, for, you know, subjectively good or bad. Maybe it's unlocked. Maybe you have to watch it first at normal speed and then you unlock it. is that the halfway compromise? All right, moving on. Netflix, staying in the world of Netflix, they announced last week that they're going to do a Splinter Cell anime series. Animated shows are getting picked up left and right because animation is one of those mediums that can be done at home where you don't need on location big studios to and stage sound stages to do production, and so Netflix is buying them up, and they've had a great success with animation recently with the Transformers show, but this is going to be from the writer of John Wick, and I know a lot of people are big fans of Splinter Cell the series on Ubisoft, and to do it in an anime style is really interesting. It's a
yeah. There's so many shows that are coming out in this way. I think this is and there's so much adult animation coming out this way. Like there's a new Transformers kind of anime style thing that debuted on Netflix a few days ago. So I'm all for this. I think this sounds great. I'm not exactly enamored with the backstory here. I'm actually not sure what the backstory is here, but there's enough here that they could make something compelling.
Yeah,
sounds great.
The Sam Fisher character has kind of gone all over the place because in all the Splinter Cell games that have come out. But, you know, hopefully the writers can have some liberties with the character, with the idea of this operative and this badass. I mean, adaptations are always tough because when you're talking about a game character, the game element, as we've talked in the past, you know, is such a big part of people's affinity and love for those series and those games, that to take that away by make that just an animated show is, you know, you have to write a really good story.
Have you watched any of Glitch Techs?
No.
It's a Netflix cartoon that I think it launched late last year, and the next season is either out now or coming out soon. Mike Mica consulted on it, helped with a couple of their storylines. And it's basically Ghostbusters meets Men in Black. It's there are video game characters that escape into the real world, and there's a secret, you know, police agency that has to put them back.
Whoa, that sounds awesome!
It's great. This is really good. I like watching it. It's very fast paced, as all these new cartoons are, and the animation style is really good.
That's great, and that's on Netflix as well.
Yep,
awesome. I'll have to check that out. All right, last bit of pop culture. We're going to circle back to Lego. At the same time, the Lego NES set dropped. There was another adult targeted Lego set that I didn't know about, and it's sold out quickly. It is the Lego Ideas Grand Piano, and this set kind of blew my mind. I know it's actually very controversial right now in the Lego community. A lot of people are not fans of it, but it did sell out. So it's a massive 3,600 piece brick set of a miniature grand piano that actually has a working mechanism so that the keys go down and don't actually play in the sense that they're striking chords, but you get a representation of the chords, the harp inside the piano being struck as the keys move up and down.
It's really cool. And apparently there's some sort of mechanism you can connect to it so it'll actually sort of act like a player piano.
So this is where it's confusing, and this is where I was a little disappointed. The promise was that there was going to be a player piano with these 25 keys, a player piano feature where you would have an app on your phone and you could create sheet music or play some pre-coded sheet music as it would display horizontally in landscape mode on your phone. You put your phone on the player on the set itself where you would have sheet music, and then these 25 keys move up and down as the phone plays music. But it looks like, because it's only 25 keys, it's just moving in tempo with the sheet music. It's not actually playing as if you would see those chords and the actual the patterns of the music.
Gotcha.
So slightly disappointing in that sense, but that gives you a sense of the size of this thing. If you could put an iPhone on its side in landscape where you would typically have like a book and sheet music, it's a pretty beefy set. It does fall into this trap of it's monotone, right? It's these glossy black bricks, and it's 3,600 pieces because you are basically building an art sculpture of this perfectly shaped grand piano. Much like I was a little disappointed with that Lego NES, it's just you're using gray bricks to make a giant gray block of the NES. Here you're making the grand piano. Although, you know, it looks very nice. The actual mechanism itself, that of the 25 keys with the hammers, like that's something I would want to take and display that versus the whole piano. But it sold out. It's temporarily out of stock. It was on back order in the first couple hours of release. And it's Lego yet again, really pushing toward the grown-up market and selling these expensive sets with incredible engineering and design. $350.
$350. That makes the Nintendo look downright affordable.
yeah. You could probably buy, you know, that's like a big chunk of a PS5 probably at that point, right? Or at $350, you'd buy a real keyboard and learn to play piano, right? But Lego.
Yep. Yes.
All right. That does it for pop culture news. So let's move on. A bit of phone news this week. Google announced, well, Samsung actually had an event just this morning for their Unpacked series announcing the new Galaxy phones. But on the Google side, earlier they announced the Pixel 5 and then available the Pixel 4a, a $350 mid-range phone that's been reviewed quite well, actually. What's the deal with the Pixel 5?
So Pixel 5 is forthcoming. Like all they said is like the real announcement's coming this fall. So I think the excitement that I have is really about the 4A. I mean, you can see the reviews out there now. I mean, it's a full plastic body. So, you know, whatever. But it's about the same size as the 11 Pro. Has a 1080p OLED screen. It's only 60 hertz. So I think if you're going down from 120 hertz phone, or even like if you have one of those weird 90 hertz phones, this can probably feel weird. But like, it has pretty good internals. It has a 730G Snapdragon inside of it, 128 gigs of storage and 6 gigs of RAM, battery that gets you through the day. They have the hole punch for the front camera instead of the notch, which I think looks fine. But overall, it has a really good camera in it, like most of the Pixel phones do, for $349. I feel like Google's meeting the moment. Like we're in a global recession. I'm sort of assuming people's, you know, ability to spend money on phones are going to be curtailed this coming year. And so I think there's going to be a huge consumer base that's looking for the basics. Can I get a phone that takes good pictures and gets me enough battery through the day? So yeah, it doesn't have the bells and whistles as, a lot of phones, but I think for a lot of people, this is going to be an awesome choice.
Yeah, especially the 5G, not needing to force 5G onto users, I think is smart right now. And there will be a 5G version of this phone for $150 more that might even have a second camera lens. And we'll see what the Pixel 5 will have, and that probably will be a 5G native phone. But that's something that I don't feel like, especially this year, you know, I'm sure carriers wanted to push it and wanted to make 2020 a big 5G year, but without stadiums, without events and places where they would have these millimeter wave broadcast towers, there's real no need for a 5G phone this year. Maybe if you're an Android fan, get the 4 this year, wait a year and a half, and then upgrade to 5G when it comes more widespread and pricing is stabilized.
Yeah, I'd wait until there's enough availability. My video.
We lost our Kishore video.
Like for whatever reason, I've gotten years younger. I think I just kicked out my camera connection. But I'll say, Jeremy, headphone jack included, buddy.
There you go. That's kicking it old school. I dig that.
Speaking of phones, Apple did say on their earnings call that their expectation is this year's iPhone will be pushed back until probably October, whereas we anticipated a September event for the new iPhones.
I think the quote was a few weeks later.
Yes, which probably is reassuring. I mean, because as investors love their results for this past quarter, people are buying up Apple products as people are staying at home and need computers and need MacBooks and are willing to pay a lot for the new, you know, the even the iPhone SE and the phones from last year. But the new phone is, this is the one that we're anticipating. We'll have a new design from the iPhone X that's been 3 years running. 5G is, again, the big question of whether they'll force users to have that. It's probably already in the manufacturing chain at this point, being, you know, only 2 months away from that. So, wow, yeah, it's already August, and we're probably going to be 2 months away from the new iPhone reveal. Sticking on Apple, they did a soft refresh on the 27-inch iMac. It's all right. Nothing exciting to say there.
It's not the new Apple chip. That's the problem. It's like they announced that they'd be making their own silicon for their PCs, and then they release an Intel Mac. And they said they would be doing that, but it definitely extinguishes some of the excitement about this product.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people are just not excited about Intel, and Intel has had a lot of missteps. They said their manufacturing, their move down to 5 nanometer would be delayed, and they might be outsourcing their manufacturing. So, you know, it's hard for people to get excited about. Yes, if they're going to buy a Mac, if they knew they're going to buy an iMac and they're planning to, this upgrade is good for them.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, if you can wait, then wait till let's see what Apple does with their native architecture.
Rumors say maybe this year even for iMacs.
Then this makes the soft refresh even worse timing. But that's not going to be Phil Schiller's problem, because Phil Schiller, director of marketing and product at Apple, is stepping down. This is a big deal. Phil Schiller was probably the most recognizable face of Apple next to Tim Cook. He's the one who did the keynotes when Steve Jobs was ill, the Phil notes. And he's going to be replaced by Greg Joswiak as head of Apple marketing. Now, this isn't just the role that's responsible for the ad campaigns. Phil Schiller still did basically was in charge of product management and did all the kind of press briefings and all the details about what goes on in the chips for the hardware. But and he's still going to be part of the company. He's going to be an Apple fellow, reports to Tim Cook, and they're running the events and the App Store. But it is a big move, and you got to wonder why now. I mean, maybe it's just time to retire. Maybe it's the pressure of this new era of Apple now that their stock is so high, and the fears that they're waiting for. Who knows what's going on with their AR headset? I haven't heard anything about that, and we'll talk a little bit about the rumors of that in the VR minute. But it is a little bit of a changing of the guard.
We aren't getting all these leaks of, like, you know, I think if there was acrimony, we'd get all these leaks of, like, you know, behind the scenes kind of stories. We're not getting any of that. So I wonder if it was just his choice and it was time.
Yeah. Yeah. And these are obviously people who love the company so much and aren't leaving a company because they see that there's going to be a downwind, you know, coming where, you know, there will be troubles. You know, it's very similar in the way that Bob Iger, you know, while stepping down as CEO at the peak of his tenure, also is coming, you know, is staying with the company and working with the company. And Phil Schiller loves Apple. Maybe he just deserves that, you know, after working there since 1987. He deserves to.
Is that true?
I think so. Yeah.
Wow. I read 96. So maybe he took a break, but wow.
Am I wrong about that?
That's, I mean, either way, he's been there well enough time to earn retirement and earn enough to retire and probably send his grandkids to college. So
yeah.
I'm sure if he wants to enjoy the rest of his life, he's an avid photographer. Maybe yep. He wants to go around shooting photos for the rest of his life.
Private jets, right?
Yes.
Just create a bubble.
More power to him.
Yeah, he's one of the few people that can do that safely. Not going to Disneyland anytime soon, though. That will be the case. Let's wrap up with some game console news. PlayStation, Sony announced the peripherals. So this is a little bit controversial. The peripherals that will be supported with the PS5. Obviously, there's a new controller and a lot of the existing peripherals, including the PSI as well as the PSVR, will work with PS5. But the PS4 controller, the DualShock, the very popular DualShock, will only work with legacy games on PS5, and new PS5 games will not support DualShock 4. That's a big deal. People are unhappy about this. Microsoft was quick to retort. New Xbox Series X compatible with all Xbox One X controllers. Because people invested hundreds of dollars on those controllers and customizing and making their own. But I understand that they wanted to create a standardized baseline for PS5 games with the new functionality, the sensors and the haptic feedback, which they've always pushed forward. Even the PS4 controller had the touchpad, had audio coming from that. But that's not enough. Whatever they're putting in that PS5 controller, they're encouraging their developers, first party, third party, otherwise, to really adopt those features.
I'm fine with that. I think that a console should start with the controller. Like the design of every game should start with, yeah, exactly, with what it feels like to the player. How is the player interacting with the game? And I think it's great if they want to force people to use that. Now, on the other hand, like I have been just sort of looking at, I have not purchased any, but I've been looking at steering wheels for VR. And I noticed that Sony did announce that all of the PS4 steering wheels will be forward compatible with the PS5. Yes.
Yeah. So I don't think it's a money-making, like it's not money-grabbing decision, right? They're not saying incompatible because they want people to buy new sets of controllers. And it does suck. Like, presumably, you're going to be able to get a free controller or a bundled controller when you buy your PS5. But for a lot of people who want to do multiplayer and to not be able to do that, or split screen, and you know, but most of these next-gen games are going to be single-player anyway, or multiplayer across internet versus split-screen, which isn't really a popular thing. I see why they made the decision. I do think that we felt like we reached peak gamepad at some point, and so it really is a question of what type of novel functionality they're going to have in a PS5 controller and PS5 games that will justify this decision. And will that be enough of a differentiator? Because I never felt like that touchpad, you know, swiping on the PS4 controller was all that meaningful. Yeah, it was interesting, and certainly for VR games like that use it as a track controller, it being another track surface was good. But like in games, it was just ended up being a D-pad.
Yes. Right? Yeah. This leads me to think they are encouraging developers to take advantage of the new features in the controller. So hopefully they will.
Yeah. Yeah. Microsoft announced that their xCloud is launching next month, September 15th. We're hearing that date a lot in the tech world, but it's launching on Android on September 15th. It's going to be part of the Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, $15 a month, and you get to do game streaming remotely. I feel like game streaming, it now should be a time where people are excited about game streaming. I just don't feel the energy there. I think people still want to play games natively on their consoles.
Maybe you're not feeling the energy there because the console manufacturers haven't decided to market a purely streaming version of a console yet. Once they do that and they put the marketing behind that, then maybe there'll be more of a buzz about it.
Or created the type of game that really showcases like things you cannot do. Maybe not even, I'm talking about graphics wise, but scale.
Like an exclusive to that style of gaming.
Yes, exclusive, not arbitrarily, but exclusive in a sense that you could only do that with the kind of server backend. You know, like Google Stadia promising like a next gen type of MMO, right? What would it mean if you could populate game worlds with thousands of characters that you couldn't render locally because of memory constraints, because of GPU constraints? That's something that game streaming we just haven't seen. And that's a huge bet. I mean, and they're not ready to make that bet when they have hardware launching and games they want to sell directly to people.
Why isn't the xCloud game streaming launching on iOS?
I think it might already be.
It says no iOS supported launch.
Good question. Its future is uncertain. I don't know. Maybe it's a Microsoft Apple relationship thing.
Maybe it's a rev share thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was a big part of last week's hearings, which Microsoft was not a part of. That's a whole separate conversation, the results of which, the effects of which, regulatory effects of which, still yet to be seen. Hey, we're going to have a science, modem science this week, Kishore? Yeah? All right, let's do it.
for a moment of science.
So I'm going to talk about something I said I wasn't going to talk about very much on this podcast, which is a COVID vaccine. There was a lot of chat on the tested Discord and some of the science channels about a vaccine and wanting to hear an update because there's been a lot of news about it. I want to explain why I don't want to talk about a vaccine very much. There's two main reasons. Like, we still have a long way to go. And by a long way to go, I mean for most of us, if, and I want to emphasize that if we're able to make an effective vaccine, it'll probably be a year, maybe even longer, before any of us actually get to receive a dose. That might be different if you're a healthcare worker, if you're in a vulnerable population, that might be slightly different as well. But I think for the wide majority of us, we're still a year away. And when you think about what a year means in the context of the timeline, the dystopian timeline that is 2020, we're 8 months from this virus really coming onto the scene. So we're talking about a timescale that's even greater than what we've experienced so far. So I think the timeline's so far out that it's hard to talk about the vaccines when knowing that there's probably going to be some ups and downs in development. And to give you context, there's over 200 vaccines in development, and they typically go through about 5 stages. There's like a preclinical stage where it's just in the lab being developed in some way, shape, or form. Then it moves typically to a phase 1 trial where it's usually a small number of people, like 20 people, to test the dosage and do some really initial like safety checks. Then it goes to phase 2, where it typically goes up to like 50, 60, 70 people to test again, safety in a population. Then it goes to something called phase 3, where it's a large study, usually 30 to 50,000 people, where they're really studying efficacy, like how effective this vaccine is at producing like the kind of antibody response or the neutralizing aspect, and then how safe is it over a wider population, and then it's going to move towards approval. That's a lot of steps. And as it stands right now, there's technically one that's been approved in China, but like it kind of skipped a bunch of steps in this process. And then there's 6 that are technically in phase 3. Two of which I'll talk about today just because they're getting the most press. So one of them is this Moderna NIH vaccine that gets a lot of press. It's been, I had Ian Hayden on the podcast, I don't know, like a month or so ago, who is a participant in phase 1 of this trial. This is really making a messenger RNA vaccine, which is going to generate an antibody response in your body before the virus infects you. And there's been really positive information in some of the animal trials they did. And then like the dosage response in humans has been pretty good. And there's encouraging evidence. So they're recruiting for a phase 3 trial right now in like 80 cities in the US. I think they're looking for 30,000 participants. But what you do in a phase 3 trial now is a bunch of people get a placebo, a bunch of people get the vaccine, and they actually weirdly sort of hope that some of these people get infected with the coronavirus in their normal daily life and see whether those that are vaccinated actually have protection versus those that have placebo. That all takes a lot of time. So that's the stage we're in with that. The other one that's kind of moving towards a similar stage is one out of Oxford. That's a partnership between Oxford and AstraZeneca. Both of these have been invested by the U.S. government at the tune of like $1 billion. It has similarly positive news. But those phase 3 trials will take months. And because of like the pressure on this, you're going to see participants in the trial probably get sort of identified by press and talk about their experience. So we're going to start to see the up and downs of this vaccine rollout, where people talk about, any effects they're feeling on a day-to-day basis, but we don't know if they have a placebo. We don't know if they actually have the vaccine. That's the whole point of this trial, is it's blinded. So they don't know either. So I think we're going to see a wave. And then in the US, with the election coming up, we know vaccines are just going to become a further part of a political discussion, which is going to make this complicated. The last thing I want to say about vaccines, that's, kind of a high level update. is that vaccine rollout works by a combination of how many people get vaccinated and the efficacy of the vaccine itself. So if you just say we produce a vaccine that's 50% effective at preventing infection and half the population gets it, that means you can just kind of almost in a very kind of rudimentary way multiply those two numbers and say we have 25% sort of immunity against the virus if things go well. Now, there's some other benefits. It's more complicated than that. But the idea is that efficacy number for this vaccine is probably not going to be 100% out the gate. It's probably not going to be 80%. It's going to be some number below that. So there's going to have to be a lot of effort put into getting that efficacy number as high as possible and then getting the coverage number as high as possible. Those are really hard things to do. Those are logistical and scientific challenges meeting together. Long story short, like our best case scenario is that this vaccine is not going to be nearly as protective as the behavioral messages that we're being encouraged to do. Like if you wear a mask, stay socially distanced, wash hands, those have a higher efficacy rate than any vaccine that we think is going to come down the line. And right now our discourse is saying vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. It's much more important for us to think about our behavior because this is still a ways away. Jeremy Williams has a question.
I had a quick question. So I understand that both the vaccines work on the principle of allowing your body to develop antibodies before you contract the disease so you can hopefully defend it. That leads me to think that we now think that antibodies help ward off this virus. Is that the case? I was under the impression that we didn't even know if people who had contracted COVID-19 were immune going forward.
So we don't fully know. But there is encouraging evidence that there are neutralizing antibodies that have been detected in people that have had COVID. How long they persist, the nature of that, whether it's in the T cell response or if it's in more of a immediate response, how long that wanes. We don't have enough time. So typically when a study comes out and says, you know, we have immunity for X time, those are done over a long timeline. Right now, the oldest infection that we know of is only 8 months in the past. So we don't have these like really well-developed studies about what immunity looks like in the future for this. And so they're just doing some modeling based off of assembling data sets from different countries with different prevalence of infection and looking at antibody loads in those different people and looking at the nature of that. So it makes for a very complicated situation where it's hard to say, you know, how effective some of these antibodies are, but there's early evidence that the neutralizing antibodies that are coming post-infection are pretty effective. There was a paper out this morning that indicated, you know, we've seen a mutation in this virus from its initial version that showed up in China that relates to like a spike protein. And that mutation allowed it to be slightly more infectious, like quote unquote, like it made it slightly more effective at binding to an ACE2 receptor on our cells. But it came at the cost that it's become more easily neutralized by certain antibodies as well, is what that paper indicated. So it's like, we have a lot of information to unpack here, but the short answer to your question is, yes, we're seeing positive data there, but we won't really know for a long time.
Question. When you say roughly a year out in terms of the expectation, how is that distributed between the necessary testing and approval process versus distribution and supply chain?
Yeah, I mean, that year out number is not mine. It's what I hear a lot of experts saying. Like there was a UCSF Grand Rounds video where they kind of polled a bunch of people that are experts in this area saying like, how long do you think it'll take until this is sort of widely available? And so it's a combination of what you're talking about. It's the approval phase, which I think some of the phase 3 trials might end as soon as the end of the year. They might go into early next year. It's hard to say because they have the recruitment process is a laborious logistical process. And then doing the analysis takes some time as well. There's some efforts to spin up manufacturing in parallel. So a billionaire said that he was going to purchase a billion doses of that AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine and just manufacture it now. It basically betting that it's going to work, right, so that that's available. So it's a mix, Norm. I think the thing that hasn't been thought through is the distribution. So we can talk about, you know, the science part, the testing, the safety, and the manufacturer. I don't think we've gotten to the point where we've really had robust discussions on distribution mechanism. We're still having discussions on who, not how.
Yeah, yeah. And all people have to go on is contagion, where it's lottery.
Yeah. I have one other update I want to talk about, which is about COVID in kids, which has become a huge focus. There was a CDC report that came out about a summer camp in Georgia. Did either of you hear about this by any chance? This is terrifying, so I apologize to you as parents. So there was an overnight camp in Georgia that convened in June. There was about 130 adults and 363 campers. Those 133 adults had like 3 days of interacting before any campers came, no masks. The campers came, they're kind of like teenager aged campers, like kind of like 10 to 15 kind of age range, maybe as young as 6, if I recall correctly. And the virus just ripped through the camp. So like almost nearly everyone in the camp tested positive, which threw into question some assumptions that we had about whether kids could be actual vectors for this. And the CDC has come out and said, indicated in a statement, kids can actually be a source of the virus itself. And what they're really saying is that we're seeing in teenagers that they can absolutely harbor the virus in a high quantity. And we're seeing it in young kids as well, like below the age of 6, that they can harbor the virus in a quantity. And it's called into question, like, what does school opening look like when we have those kids? A lot of our models for how to open school from a public health standpoint all come from modeling the transmission of influenza A, because we've never really done this. So evidence is just emerging around what transmission of SARS-CoV-2 could look like in a school. We have some information from Israel that's not encouraging. We have some information from Germany that's more encouraging around elementary. But this is a very complicated thing that we have very little data on at this point. From a science standpoint, the best analysis that I've heard from epidemiologists is A, this is a changing landscape, but the transmission kind of analysis is going to look different from influenza A, and it's going to look different across age ranges of kids. But all of that's caveated saying, like, kids are going to get this. We're all parents. Like, would you want to have any kids get this? That would be devastating if we see a large portion of kids get sick, let alone be carriers of the virus.
Do you know what percentage of that camp's kids were asymptomatic or had mild symptoms compared to having
symptoms? I don't recall off the top of my head. But I mean, the fact that they're testing positive and we don't know what the long-term ramifications of having this is not great. And because it's we're talking about kids. Like, you know, I think this is a tough place. So I think there's not a lot of firm guidance to have any sort of strong position pro or anti going back to school at this point. I have a weird story. You want a weird story to wrap up?
Okay.
Okay. This is a little gross, but I think it's fun. So this has made its way around science Twitter all week. There was a analysis that came out of a lab led by Shinji Suguria at Kobe University in Japan. And he was looking at the habits of these beetles. And I'm going to be playing a video on if you're watching on YouTube, but I'll narrate along. So he was studying these aquatic beetles. And what he did was he fed one to this frog. And so Norm and Jeremy are watching this frog eat this aquatic beetle. And so, okay, frog eats beetle, no problem. Here we are about 2 hours later at 4x speed. We are watching the frog poop out the beetle. And the beetle's still alive.
No, no.
No.
The beetle is still alive.
Okay? I'm stepping away from this. Okay. I'll be back after this segment.
I don't blame you. That
is gross.
This is the first documented situation where we have an animal that has entered the digestive tract and successfully left the other end, as they like to say. And
that's the first time
that we have like real documented evidence of this as like as a behavior and a successful one. So what they did was they actually tested this. So what they did is they bound the legs of the beetle to see, is this something where the beetle is just undigestible and could do it? Or are they actively doing something? Is this an evolutionary behavior that was developed? The beetles that were bound all died in the tract, and they weren't sort of secreted in that way. The beetles that had motion, 90% of them emerged within 6 hours alive. And so the theory is that the beetle is actually crawling along, this millimeter-sized beetle, it's crawling along the intestinal tract, gets to the sphincter of the frog, does a little tickling to open up the sphincter, and is released and alive. So it's an amazing evolutionary behavior that's been developed.
And receives all of the nutrients it needs, either from the air or whatever surroundings, for that 4 hour period.
Yeah, sure. You can call it nutrients. I think that's all I have for science this week. And I think I've grossed out Norm to the point where he's never coming back to this podcast.
Whew, that is a weird one.
Yeah, I told you it was weird. Should we go to the VR minute?
No, he said he's going to be back. Can you wait?
Yeah, of course I can wait.
He'll be back. He's going to cut here, I think.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality this week.
What a seamless transition. Seamless. It's like nothing ever changed. I was not gone for a minute. That's story, Kishore. Gross.
And the timing was perfect. If anyone watches this on 2X, it's going to be lost.
Got a bunch of VR stuff to talk about. First of all, Microsoft Flight Simulator. This is probably, maybe the biggest VR news this week.
The fact that there is VR news associated is the news. Like, people were clamoring, like, please give us VR support with Flight Simulator. And for the longest time, like, they never committed to it. They were always
saying they were interested.
Yes.
Yeah. We understand. We hear you. Maybe we'll put some resources in. But the news is, although the game's coming out next week, August 18th, that's right, in 2 weeks' time, it will have VR support basically right after launch, shortly after launch with, and this is the interesting part, with the HP Reverb 2.
Well, now, just to be clear, the launch of VR will coincide with the release of the HP Reverb 2, G2. But right. I don't think it's going to be exclusive to the Reverb 2.
That's where there's confusion, right? So come August 18th, if you have a Valve Index, if you have a Rift S, even if you have Samsung Odyssey Plus or Reverb 1, presumably you won't be able to play Flight Simulator in VR yet. Now, whenever HP is ready to announce the release date for the G2 and that comes out, that is when there will be some type of unlocking. And what the Flight Simulator developers have said is that while it will support a wide range of all, PC-based VR headsets, they're going to start with the G2.
I don't read that. It's the release says VR support will be available later this year in time for the launch of the HP Reverb G2. So it sounds like the launch of the feature will coincide with that product, but I don't think it's going to be exclusive to it. I know that we talked about that.
Yeah.
I thought that was the case. It was going to be exclusive, but it doesn't actually read that way. I think that they're using this press release as a way to boost excitement for the Reverb G2, since it is a Windows mixed reality headset.
That's right. That's right. And presumably they, being close partners, are developing with that in mind. And it being a simulation game, is one that will benefit from the high pixel density of the G2.
100%.
But it's not a bundle, right? Like the G2 isn't coming with that. That would be quite a get if it was to be a bundle. though, but I'm sure there's money reasons. I would rather, you know, sell you a $600 headset plus a $60 game or more if you want the deluxe versions. Speaking of the Reverb G2.
Huh?
I have one right here.
That's a beautiful headset, Norm. Woo!
There will be a video about this probably a few hours after you listen to this podcast, or maybe out already. It's still yet to be finished filming and edited. But I've been using this for almost a week now. And Jeremy, you had a couple of days to spend with this as well.
Yepers.
You also have a G1. So I don't want to say everything I want to say about that because that would be the full video.
I'm not in the video. So okay. let me briefly just say that coming from a G1, the controllers are night and day.
Yes.
Controllers for the G1, as everyone knows who has a WMR headset, they're poor. They are ergonomically uncomfortable after an hour of playing. It's like holding a couple rectangles and they dig into your hands. All the controls are in the wrong spot. The first version of WMR controllers were basically meant to be like Vive. Wands, essentially, like parity with that device, which is all about the touchpad. They finally moved the analog sticks now to the, and it all sort of feels like a Oculus Touch controller, knockoff. It's much better than the original WMR controllers. It's not quite as good as Touch because it is heavier, it's front heavy, but it's totally acceptable. Like now I could say, okay, this controller could be your one and only headset and you could get along with it. Previously, the Reverb G1 was really recommended to people who wanted to play cockpit games exclusively, who were using other peripherals to control the games, like steering wheels or even game pads. The controllers were just not comfortable. I'm glad they fixed that. Otherwise, it's the same resolution, so you're going to get that sweet 4K per eye. It's like
2K,
looking at
2K per eye, 2K by 2K, 4K total.
Right, exactly, like a 4K monitor per eye.
Not per eye. 2K by 2K for each eye, I believe. I don't believe it's 4K for each eye.
No, but that 4K resolution is that not what we're talking about? Is that not what that is?
No.
What's 4K resolution?
As you're figuring this out, I think it's more important to say, like, how did it compare visually to you to the Index in terms of your experience? Could you see a difference?
You're right. Yes. I'm sorry. It's like half 4K per eye. Yeah.
I mean, it's how what Pimax would call, basically a 4K headset.
Exactly.
4K by 2K, essentially. It's noticeably, I mean, we had the G1 last year and the Index last year, and, the G1 far and away outside of Vario and what they're using with their high density center field of view, this one is the best pixel density for any headset because they're small panels. They're like 2.89-inch panels. As we talked about when they made the announcement, this is a strong partnership with the Valve as well. So the lenses, while they're not the same lenses as the Valve Index, they have a lot of the same qualities, the same stack, I think, of those Fresnel lenses. And so you lose so much of the visual artifacts that were in the G1, noticeably the Mira, and they also get the benefits of the Valve Index headphone drivers, the speaker drivers, not headphones. It's not fair to call them headphones.
There's still chromatic aberration around the edges. It's still a VR headset. There's still a little bit of warping around the center, that sweet spot. But man, I'm telling you, like when I got the G1 just like a month ago off of eBay because I couldn't wait for this G2. I use it for playing virtual pinball. You can play visual pinball VR, which is a perfect use case for the Reverb. You're not using the original WAN controllers, and you, for the same reason you want this for a driving sim or a space sim, you want to see high res in the distance.
Yeah,
it just looks so far better. It's like sitting into a warm bath. I swear to God, it's like my eyes are just finally comfortable in VR. There's something about the every other VR headset, and we know this, which is just like the resolution is early days and all the games have been designed for that resolution. But if you have these styles of games that can take advantage of a higher resolution, and you want to read text, for instance, in Elite Dangerous or even on your desktop, this is now, like, when you get this 2K per eye, it's like, it is that threshold, and it's a wonderful thing.
Did you try it with Alex? Just yes. Out of curiosity?
Yeah.
And how was that experience?
It's one of those things where I actually, we haven't done official benchmarks. It's funky because just like it, it's not a Steam VR native headset. You run the Steam software on top of Windows Mixed Reality. And Windows Mixed Reality has its own settings. So for example...
So it's not Revive you use? You use
something else? You use Steam, and Windows has Mixed Reality Portal, which is their version of the Oculus interface and store. And you get to go in this, you know, this VR interface for loading menus and putting your web browser and desktop along the wall to read it. And the settings in there allow for, because it's a very high resolution headset and they want this to be used not just on high-end PCs, but on laptops as well, you can do scaling and you can also do refresh rate changes. So there's compatibility modes where you can say, render this at 1440 by 1440 and then double up in Windows Mixed Reality, or run it at 60 hertz and run it at 60 hertz on the low end and be okay at 60 hertz. While at the same time, because Steam runs on top of that, you can also have Steam say, do super sampling in Steam and do motion interpolation in Steam, reprojection in Steam. And so there's a lot of like weird like tweaking you can do, but it's good for the users because you can get optimize it for your system. But my long story short is running everything at native. So 2160 by 2160, I want to say, 90 hertz, 100% sampling, no reprojection in Steam. Alex looked fantastic to a point where I didn't even need textures to be super sharp. Geometry being sharp and the effects, the particle effects looking so sharp at, you know, pixel perfect, was just comfortable and way more immersive.
Yep. It's that comfort factor. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's eye fatigue. So I'm not like physical head fatigue. It's literally right. The strain of like looking at details. Cause you're, you know, these are all fixed focus, right? They're convergence, not accommodating. And so when you're looking at things in distance, your eye biologically wants to squint and see things that aren't in focus. And on headsets that we have today, where because of the resolution of the screen, because of the lenses, you just can't see things that are sharper, your brain doesn't know what to do with that. But here, when things are actually pixel sharp, that far away, and you don't get basically any screen door effect, it just is, it's less fatiguing.
It's important to point out that this is all of the pixels of you know, 2160 by 2160 forced into the same FOV as like a Rift S,
yeah,
or
yeah,
a Quest or something, versus what Pimax did, which was spread it across, you know, your peripheral and your field of view. So, I mean, it really is, everything is there. It's almost like the brute force method of what
Vario
did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there are things I'll talk about in the video about the ergonomics and the design. This is a prototype, so there is not final production materials, and some of the fit and finish and stuff and some of the drivers and calibration. But, you know, we'll I have your G1, I have HP's prototype G2, and be able to show some comparisons. So stay tuned for that video. We're going to talk more about the Oculus Quest leak a little bit. Now, this is new information, new analysis.
It's not information.
It's analysis.
Yeah.
It's analysis from Robert Scoble.
Yeah.
Like a 2-hour-long interview he did, wide-ranging, about mixed reality technologies. I think he has a new book coming out about that, but specifically about the Quest. And I think this interview is probably done before the leaks happen or around the same time. So I'm not sure if it's directly referring to that, but his thinking is that this will be a Quest Pro and not a Quest Go.
Right. He suggests that there is a bigger market for a better Quest than there is for a cheaper Quest, which is great for me because that's what I want, and I'm all in. But people had thought, since it was this like lighter color, more of like a Go color scheme, that this is sort of like the new replacement for the Go, which is of course a discontinued Oculus 3DOF headset. that this would be like a lower tier quest and appeal to people who wanted to spend maybe, you know, $200 or $300 versus $400 for the quest. But his argument is that nobody that he has ever spoken to cares about $100 when it comes to, you know, getting a quest in their hands. What they want is to be able to read text. And so that's why he's thinking that this is going to be a $600 quest that has, as we said, just like the same thing as the Reverb 4K screen or a 2K by 2K screen.
For that to run on a mobile processor means a much beefier processor, GPU especially. Right. Even we're talking about just geometry. We're not talking about video memory for textures or anything, which we all know are not as important. It's all about the rendering and also the frame rate. So the other thing he says is that he presumes his thinking is that this could be a 90 hertz panel or even a 120 hertz panel.
We know that the current Quest can do 90 based on Carmack's talk from the last Oculus Connect, where he said they figured out how to do it later, but said they already passed through FCC approvals. They'd have to resubmit, and they didn't want to do that. So it's no surprise that this could do 90. The 120 is the interesting figure.
You think that's necessary? I mean, when you're already talking about stretching the limits of a mobile processor, 120 just seems gratuitous at that point. I understand the benefits. Like I play my Index at 120 because it is smoother. It is more comfortable, that extra temporal information. But on a mobile side, that seems that, I mean, I don't know. They're not doing their own silicon. How could they push that many pixels?
I would love it to be an opt-in thing. You know, just give users a slider. Maybe they want to sacrifice visual quality for frame rate. You know, turn it into a little, you know, PC experience where you can configure it however you want to. Certainly not every game would support it at the highest visual quality. You're right. But that 120 hertz is pretty nice if you try it. It is noticeable compared to 90.
Yeah. Yeah. It's again, the fatigue of it all. It's feeling more present, more a sharpness in your attention, your feeling of a presence in the content. If this is to be a pro, the thing that worries me is the headband, is the ergonomics. Now,
right.
they want to improve the ergonomics of the Quest and get less of the weight off the front of it. And that's why Deluxe Audio head strap has been such a good solution. From the leaked photos and the leaked render of what this device looks to be, I'm unconvinced that that has the ergonomic comfort of a high-end VR headset.
It would have to be substantially lighter. And I mean, even more so than the Go. And I just don't even see that being a factor.
Or they're going to do their own version of an aftermarket head strap.
That fine, sign me up. I'll pay extra $100 for that.
Right, and exactly, and then it really becomes, we're talking about $700 or more. Better cameras, all the things that we kind of expect. Battery life is not something he kind of speculated on, but it's interesting. You know, if he's right about it, and I can see it being that way because Quest has already been sold out everywhere during the lockdown and there's plenty of demand. And if they have the manufacturing chains in place to lower the current price of the existing Quest to make that the entry-level product, that's a great thing. The question is, what does that mean for a desktop-based headset? Because I can't see this being also a desktop-based headset unless it's the same type of compressed video passed through to USB-C as is currently implemented in Quest.
Yeah, I think that that's the solution. Is you basically, you have two SKUs. You have this, the Quest Pro with the built-in tracking processor. Of course, you'd have to have this in this other one too. Then you have a cheaper one without the actual processor in there. You just have the bare essentials in order to do inside-out tracking, and it's a Link headset. It is basically the follow-up to the Rift 2.
That's so disappointing, because while Link is a stopgap measure in my mind, Link compressed video over a tethered cable is a stepping stone to do compressed video over wireless, which I understand that would have to be the case. But if I'm going to have a tethered cable, I want the raw output from the GPU. And the unfortunate thing is that DisplayLink standard that was going to be a thing in GPUs that Oculus was on board with to do essentially USB-C connection over from GPU to headset, that's what I would want out of this rather than going through a compression process.
Yeah.
And a video decoding process. Speaking of wireless, over on the Valve side, apparently there's a Valve patent for, it looks like, a wireless transmission system for VR. Wireless data transport for HMDs. We know they've been wanting to do wireless for a while. I think Gabe has said as much as a possible path forward for the Index, more power to them. I think wireless for desktop compute is one way we need VR to go, both in home and on location.
Is this just a 50 gigahertz solution like the ones that already exist?
It must be. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what is different in this patent than what is already exists, but you know, they filed for it and I haven't time to parse through it. Last thing, we didn't talk about this last week, but Dreams has VR support.
Yeah.
PSVR, Dreams, and people are making all sorts of crazy stuff. Amazing things.
Yeah, I am still too afraid to even install Dreams because I know you won't see me anymore. I'll just get lost in it, making things. And it's got such an amazing app. And of course, it's like super cheap now. I think it started at 40 and I think it's already dropped in price. And now full VR support. So somebody has, I just saw in the show notes, I watched the video, somebody has designed, since Dreams launched in VR, which was only like a week and a half ago, the entire Indy ride from Disneyland.
Yes.
Incredible. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like Dreams. And the one is incredible. The scripting of it all, all this reminds me of when people were creating like computers in Minecraft, right? Like 10 years ago. And
right.
And all of this is just untapped potential as they've created this powerful sandbox. Visually, you know, the more time you spend in it, the better they're going to get. And some of the most impressive stuff I've seen in Dreams are like just these vignettes, these scenes that people have created, just look like the best, you know, CG art you've seen on DeviantArt, but created with controller
and on
the PS4. Exactly. Yeah. And on the PS4. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Bring it to PC, please.
Yeah. Yeah. We'd love it. Has there been, Sony's put stuff out on PC. We've seen, Detroit, what is that? The Human game. Mm-hmm. And as well as Horizon Zero Dawn out on PC. So, you know, I don't think they would be.
Are either of those first party?
No, but those were PlayStation exclusives.
Yeah. I mean, same with Tetris Effect, but I don't know. Like Media Molecule is owned by Sony, you know, 100%. So I wonder if we'll see that, but I certainly hope so. Cause it would absolutely disrupt the game development community, I would think. It's such an affordable game engine that you can make things with. I mean, currently there is no way to sell your stuff on the PlayStation Store. Like that's the thing that's keeping it from being a microtransaction based, you know, way for people to earn money. But on the PC, I would imagine that's how it would work. It'd be amazing.
Yeah. Show us what next PSVR looks like. That's what I'm curious about.
Yeah.
He did say that, going back to the Scoble interview, that he thinks next PSVR will be wireless.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. But his main thing is the Apple AR. And he thinks that's coming in 2021. He thinks there's people already trying devices out in the public at national parks.
19 different prototypes. And the distinguishing factor is that it will be tetherless.
Right.
That would be surprising to me.
And like their huge leg up, which is that they can say it's only a $500 headset, whereas Magic Leap and everyone else has to say it's a $2,000 headset, and they're both selling $2,000 headsets. It's just that you don't consider your phone as a part of the buy-in for your AR headset. You don't consider the AirPod Pros as a part of the buy-in because you already own those, or you're planning to buy them anyway. You've already budgeted them.
So you're saying wireless transmission between headset and phone for processing, and I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that Apple headset will absolutely use the phone for processing. Why wouldn't it? It's like a supercomputer.
But then he's saying that the headsets that are being tested right now are all tetherless.
I would assume
to
a phone.
They have to be wireless. They're tetherless to a phone. So not tethered to a phone physically, but it would have to be tethered wirelessly. So whatever Apple announces in October for next iPhone would have to have that technology to make that transmission possible, low latency, high bandwidth, from headset to phone, from phone to headset, pocket to head.
He's also really confident about technology I never even knew existed, which is that the glasses themselves will be configurable to different prescriptions.
That's we heard that rumor before, that they were going to have this, you know, it's one of the reasons why it can only launch in a place, in a world where people can go to stores again, but just like people try on their watch straps, that institutional knowledge of the watch strap stuff will allow them to do prescription in, you know, testing in stores and have a supply chain to get that, and maybe a home testing for your own prescription.
No, the glasses will change. They can change every day. They can change throughout the day to different prescriptions.
Exactly.
That was my reaction.
That would be groundbreaking, not only for AR technologies, but for glasses technologies, glasses in general.
Yeah. Well, he made the point. He said, you know, people's prescriptions actually change throughout the day based on what they eat, what the weather's like, how much sleep they got. And he's saying that these glasses will be able to compensate for that.
All right. So says Scoble. Okay. That does it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. If you are someone who are music inclined or just wants to create a piece of music, this one-off, we're taking new intro pieces. Any genre requests from you guys?
Hip-hop.
There we go. Hip-hop. Yeah. Yeah, you know, we didn't even talk about in tech, Microsoft possibly buying TikTok. We'll see if it happens. I don't get TikTok. I'm of the millennial era. You see that Rolling
Stones?
TikTok
is awesome. TikTok is really awesome, but this deal is just a mess.
I can appreciate the social power and the platform, but just like that Rolling Stone article has talked about how TikTok is a Gen Z thing, and they've turned against Lin-Manuel Miranda because he is I'll share the story with you. TikTok users are having none of Lin-Manuel Miranda because he is the quintessential millennial and they are post-millennial. In that same sense, TikTok is not for me. And so good luck, Microsoft. We'll talk about that whenever it does happen. Anyway, an outro this week comes from Wohawk. It's an oldie from our archives. If you want to create one of those, we'll take that as well to play in the future. But here it goes.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
All right, I put a big picture on the screen behind you. It's of telescopes looking at the night sky. Do you notice anything about the image, gentlemen?
Yes, there's satellites in the sky.
That streak you see across the sky are the Starlink satellites that SpaceX has been launching. And astronomers are pissed. Internet satellites. Streams of satellites.
Yeah, they want to have hundreds of these.
There are so many of them that they're interfering with astronomical observations. Internet. Astronomers are pissed.
And they probably remain pissed.
That was great.
All right. We miss you, Wohawk. See everyone next time. Bye.